Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time. This is Doyle Shamley here in Eager, Arizona. Now, today, on the Hour of the Time, the 17th of February, got it right today, 2005, we are going to cover several topics. We're going to finish up with part two, the conclusion of War is a Racket. We're also going to cover more on the World Economic Forum, held in Davos, Switzerland. And so you can see some of the impacts of that World Economic Forum, as it's called. I covered the first part on Monday concerning the forum. Today we'll conclude part two of that, and also how it can affect some current potential legislation right now trying to get through at the FAA and the federal level concerning our airports. It all meshes in. It doesn't just happen by accident. Now, if you'd like to contact the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona 85925. If you'd like to visit our website, it is an excellent website, one of the best, with a huge compendium of research materials, permanent areas of research, new news, updates, and of course, all our research materials that are available for donations. That is hourofthetime.com. Again, that's hourofthetime.com. Now, if you'd like to email either myself or Rob Houghton, the co-host and webmaster, you can do that at the very top of the website. There's a link, contact us. My email address is hourofthetime@hotmail.com, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. And one thing before we get on to the content of the show today, I need to remind everybody, if you see fit in yourselves, we need your support. The Hour of the Time is listener supported. You notice we don't have ads running on our show. We don't sell light bulbs or alien spaceships or ray guns or any of that stuff. So, we sell our research materials only. Your donations keep the Hour of the Time on the air, the 365 days a year, the massive cost of that website. It's huge. The cost of research and updates, the constant internet feeds and email, lights, electricity, water, etc. You understand all that. We need your support. You can do that through our new catalog, which is all the products except for, of course, the very newest ones. You can't send a catalog out every week. Everything since the Hour of the Time started in 1993 up to the end of Bill's broadcasting career when he was murdered. Plus all the special series, the DVDs, all that is listed in there. To get that catalog, simply send me at the Hour of the Time $5, and I'll shoot one out right to you. I send them first-class mail so they come fast and not all beat up. And that is Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona 85925. On our website, we have PayPal. Now, it is quite the task getting those little Buy Now buttons when we have the amount of items that we have. So they're on the highlight items right now, but of course, right on the front top of the page is a Donate Now button. You can simply go to that, and people have done it, and it works just the same, except for in the message text you simply put, I want show 1932, such and such. I want the World Economic Forum, date so and so, you know. And it still works the same until we have those little buttons next to every item. So please, if you can find that in yourselves, to do so, that keeps us, the biggest thorn in the New World Order side, alive and on the air and constantly expanding. Over the next week, you're going to see and hear some major new products available to you, never been available before, that are going to be absolutely great for your research, and they're going to be priced very nicely for you. Very good. Because I and some researchers in our field, amongst our intelligence service and Rob, are doing all the work in-house, we were able to keep the overhead extremely low, put out a professionally packaged, nice research CD, and this is only the first one. We're already putting together three or four more very special sets. Now, I'm going to take a quick musical break, get my different type stuff. I was printing stuff out 2 minutes before I called WBCQ. Got in the door late today. And get my paperwork in order and get on with the show. Ladies and gentlemen, again, you're listening to the Hour of the Time on WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz and 9.330 megahertz out of Monticello, Maine. Now today, I'm going to start off with part two and the conclusion of War is a Racket, a quick cover and overview of what we covered yesterday. It was written by Mr. Smedley Darlington Butler, and he's not just your ordinary person. He was a major general, retired United States Marine Corps, went on to be, of course, highly educated, serve in public office at the state levels in Philadelphia. He was a Republican candidate for Senate in 1932. Now, of course, this is very old writing. I think most notably, considering the subject matter of the piece, War is a Racket, which can be read in one nice sitting. It's a nice little booklet. Is the fact that he was a major general in the Marine Corps, and he was one of only 19 people ever in United States history to earn the highest medal in the world for bravery, the Congressional Medal of Honor. He won two of them and lived to tell about it. It's rare to earn even one and live to tell about it. Almost all of them are awarded posthumously, but to live and have one is incredible, and to have two of them and make it through is real incredible. And that all gives a lot of credence to the subject matter at hand. Now, you may ask, why are you reading something that was written in the 30s? Well, it's history, first off. History repeats itself. When you hear in this writing, as I covered yesterday on the show, the fact that he categorically outlined World War II 10 years before it ever happened, even with quotes from Mussolini, for instance, and of course, the socialist publications, the New World Order publications like the Carnegie Endowment in their paper and monthly circulator in the country at the time, it's quite amazing. And when you read and hear this on the air, it sounds as if he was talking about today. So, I would suggest you find this. I offered the link to the electronic version of the full text yesterday on the air, but no one took me up on the offer, so I'm not going to waste my time, and I erased the link today, so don't ask me now. But it was written by Major General retired Smedley Butler. If you want info on him, I suggest going to the National Congressional Medal of Honor Society or doing a search for his little book, War is a Racket. Now I'm going to recap briefly part of yesterday's broadcast to bring that way you get into the new material easier and verbatim from the piece. In the government hospital in Marion, Indiana, 1,800 of these boys are in pens, 500 of them in a barracks with steel bars and wires all around outside the buildings and on the porches. These boys already have been mentally destroyed. These boys don't even look like human beings. Oh, the looks on their faces. Physically, they are in good shape. Mentally, they are gone. There are thousands and thousands of these cases, and more are coming in all the time. The tremendous excitement of the war, the sudden cutting off of that excitement, the young boys couldn't stand it. That's a part of the bill. So much for the dead. They have paid their part of the war profits. So much for the mentally and physically wounded. They are paying now their share of the war profits. But the others paid too. They paid with heartbreaks when they tore themselves away from their firesides and their families to don the uniform of Uncle Sam, on which a profit had been made. They paid another part in the training camps where they were regimented and drilled while others took their jobs and their places in their lives of their communities. They paid for it in the trenches where they were shot and were shot, where they were hungry for days at a time, where they slept in the mud, in the cold, and in the rain, with the moans and the shrieks of the dying for a horrible lullaby. But don't forget, the soldier paid part of the dollar and cents bill, too. Up to and including the Spanish-American War, we had a prize system, and soldiers and sailors fought for money. During the Civil War, they were paid bonuses, in many instances before they went into service. The government or states paid as high as $1,200 for an enlistment. In the Spanish-American War, they gave prize money. When we captured any vessels, the soldiers all got their share. At least they were supposed to. Then when it was found out that we could reduce the cost of war by taking all the prize money and keeping it, but conscripting, redrafting the soldiers anyway, then soldiers couldn't bargain for their labor. Everyone else could bargain, but the soldier couldn't. Napoleon once said, "All men are enamored of decorations. They positively hunger for them." So, by developing the Napoleonic system, the metal business, the government learned it could get soldiers for less money because the boys liked to be decorated. Until the Civil War, there were no medals. Then the Congressional Medal of Honor was handed out. It made enlistments easier. After the Civil War, no new medals were issued until the Spanish-American War. In the World War I, that is, we used propaganda to make the boys accept conscription. They were made to feel ashamed if they didn't join the army. So vicious was this war propaganda that even God was brought into it. With few exceptions, our clergymen joined in the clamor to kill, kill, kill. To kill the Germans. God is on our side. It is His will that the Germans be killed. And in Germany, the good pastors called upon the Germans to kill the Allies to please the same God. This was part of the general propaganda built up to make people war-conscious and murder-conscious. Beautiful ideals were painted for our boys who were sent out to die. This was the, quote, war to end all wars. This was the, quote, war to make the world safe for democracy. No one mentioned to them as they marched away that their going and their dying would mean huge war profits. No one told these American soldiers they might be shot down by bullets made by their own brothers here. No one told them that the ships on which they were going to cross might be torpedoed by submarines built with United States patents. They were just told it would be a glorious adventure. Thus, having stuffed patriotism down their throats, it was decided to make them help pay for the war, too. So we gave them the large salary of $30 a month. All they had to do for this munificent sum was to leave their dear ones behind, give up their jobs, lie in swampy trenches, eat canned willy when they could get it, and kill and kill and kill and be killed. But wait, half of that wage, which is just a little more than a riveter in a shipyard or a laborer in a munitions factory safe at home made in a day, was promptly taken from him to support his dependents, so that they would not become a charge upon his community. Then we made him pay what amounted to accident insurance, something the employer pays for in an enlightened state. And that cost him $6 a month. He had less than $9 a month left. Then, the most crowning insolence of all, he was virtually blackjacked into paying for his own ammunition, clothing, and food by being made to buy Liberty Bonds. Most soldiers got no money at all on paydays. We made them buy Liberty Bonds at $100, and then we bought them back, when they came back from the war and couldn't find work, at $84 and $86. And the soldiers bought about $2 billion worth of these bonds. Yes, the soldier pays the greater part of the bill. His family pays too. They pay it in the same heartbreak that he does. As he suffers, they suffer. At nights, as he lay in the trenches and watch shrapnel burst about him, they lay home in their beds and toss sleeplessly. His father, his mother, his wife, his sisters, his brothers, his sons, and his daughters. When he returned home minus an eye, or minus a leg, or with his mind broken, they suffered too, as much as and even sometimes more than he. Yes, and they too contributed their dollars to the profits of the munitions makers and bankers and shipbuilders and the manufacturers and the speculators. They too bought Liberty Bonds and contributed to the profit of the bankers after the armistice and the hocus pocus of manipulated Liberty Bond prices. And even now, the families of the wounded men and of the mentally broken and those who never were able to readjust themselves are still suffering and still paying. Chapter 4. How to smash this racket. Well, it's a racket, all right. A few profit, and the many pay. But there is a way to stop it. You can't end it by disarmament conferences. You can't eliminate it by peace parleys at Geneva. Well-meaning but impractical groups can wipe it out by resolutions. It can be smashed effectively only by taking the profit out of war. The only way to smash this racket is to conscript capital and industry and labor before the nation's manhood can be conscripted. 1 month before the government can conscript the young men of the nation, it must conscript capital and industry and labor. Let the officers and the directors and the high-powered executives of our armament factories and our munitions makers and our shipbuilders and our airplane builders and the manufacturers of all the other things that provide profit in wartime, as well as the bankers and the speculators, be conscripted to get $30 a month, the same wage as the lads in the trenches get. Let the workers in these plants get the same wages. All the workers, all the presidents, all executives, all directors, all managers, all bankers. Yes, and all generals and all admirals and all officers and all politicians and all government office holders. Everyone in the nation be restricted to a total monthly income not to exceed that paid to the soldiers in the trenches. Let all these kings and tycoons and masters of business and all those workers in industry and all our senators and governors and majors pay half of their monthly $30 wage to their families and pay war risk insurance and buy Liberty Bonds. Why shouldn't they? They aren't running any risk of being killed or of having their bodies mangled or their minds shattered. They aren't sleeping in muddy trenches. They aren't hungry. The soldiers are.
Give capital and industry and labor 30 days to think it over, and you will find by that time there will be no war. That will smash the war racket, that and nothing else. Maybe I am a little too optimistic. Capital still has some say. So capital won't permit the taking of their profit out of war until the people, those who do the suffering and still pay the price, make up their minds that those they elect to office shall do their bidding and not that of the profiteers. Another step necessary in this fight to smash the war racket is a limited plebiscite to determine whether a war should be declared. Plebiscite, not of all the voters, but merely of those who would be called upon to do the fighting and dying. There wouldn't be very much sense in having a 76-year-old president of a munitions factory, or the flat-footed head of an international banking firm, or the cross-eyed manager of a uniform manufacturing plant, all of whom see visions of tremendous profits in the event of war, voting on whether the nation should go to war or not. They never would be called upon to shoulder arms, to sleep in a trench, and to be shot. Only those who would be called upon to risk their lives for our country should have the privilege of voting to determine whether the nation should go to war. There is ample precedent for restricting the voting to those affected. Many of our states have restrictions on those permitted to vote. As an aside, ladies and gentlemen, remember the time of the writing when he cites these restrictions on who can vote. Back to the piece. In most, it is necessary to be able to read and write before you may vote. In some, you must own property. It would be a simple matter each year for the men coming of military age to register in their communities as they did in the draft during the World War and be examined physically. Those who could pass and would therefore be called upon to bear arms in the event of war would be able to vote in a limited plebiscite. They should be the ones to have the power to decide, not a Congress, few of whose members are within the age limit, and fewer still of whom are in physical condition to bear arms. Only those who must suffer should have the right to vote. A third and most important step in this business of smashing the war racket is to make certain that our military forces are truly forces for defense only. At each session of Congress, the question of further naval appropriations comes up. The swivel chair admirals of Washington, and there are always a lot of them, are very adroit lobbyists, and they are smart. They don't shout that we need a lot of battleships to war on this nation or that nation. Oh no. First of all, they let it be known that America is menaced by a great naval power. Almost any day, these admirals will tell you, the great fleet of this supposed enemy will strike suddenly and annihilate 125 million people, just like that. Then they begin to cry for a larger navy. For what? To fight the enemy? Oh my no. Oh no. For defense purposes only. Then, incidentally, they announce maneuvers in the Pacific. For defense? Uh-huh. The Pacific is a great big ocean. We have a tremendous coastline on the Pacific. Will the maneuvers be off the coast 200 or 300 miles? Oh no, the maneuvers will be 2,000, yes, perhaps even 3,500 miles off the coast. The Japanese, a proud people, of course, will be pleased beyond expression to see the United States fleet so close to Nippon shores. Even as pleased, as would be the residents of California were they to dimly discern through the morning mist the Japanese fleet playing at war games off Los Angeles. The ships of our Navy, it can be seen, should be specifically limited by law to within 200 miles of our coastline. Had that law been in effect in 1898, the Maine would never have gone to Havana Harbor. She never would have been blown up. There would have been no war with Spain, and it's an attendant loss of life. 200 miles is ample, in the opinions of experts, for defense purposes. Our nation cannot start an offensive war if its ships can't go farther than 200 miles off the coastline. Planes might be permitted to go as far as 500 miles from the coast for purposes of reconnaissance. And the army should never leave the territorial limits of our nation. To summarize, three steps must be taken to smash the war racket. We must take the profit out of war. We must permit the youth of the land who bear arms to decide whether or not there should be war. We must limit our military forces to home defense purposes. Chapter 5, to hell with war. I am not a fool as to believe that war is a thing of the past. I know that people do not want war, but there is no use in saying we cannot be pushed into another war. Looking back, Woodrow Wilson was reelected president in 1916 on a platform that he had, quote, kept us out of war, end quote, and on the implied promise that he would, quote, keep us out of war, end quote. Yet 5 months later, he asked Congress to declare war on Germany. In that 5 month interval, the people had not been asked whether they had changed their minds. The 4 million young men who put on uniforms and marched or sailed away were not asked whether they wanted to go forth to suffer and die. Then what caused our government to change its mind so suddenly? Money. An Allied commission, it may be recalled, came over shortly before the war declaration and called on the president. The president summoned a group of advisors. The head of the commission spoke. Stripped of its diplomatic language, this is what he told the president and his group. There is no use kidding ourselves any longer. The cause of the Allies is lost. We now owe you, that is, American bankers, American munitions makers, American manufacturers, American speculators, American exporters, $5 or $6 billion. If we lose, and without the help of the United States, we must lose, we, England, France, and Italy, cannot pay back this money, and Germany won't. So, had secrecy been outlawed as far as war negotiations were concerned, had the press been invited to be present at that conference, or had radio been available to broadcast the proceedings, America never would have entered the World War. But this conference, like all war discussions, was shrouded in utmost secrecy. When our boys were sent off to war, they were told it was a, quote, war to make the world safe for democracy, and a war to end all wars. Well, 18 years after, the world has less of democracy than it had then. Besides, what business it is of ours, whether Russia or Germany or England or France or Italy or Austria, live under democracies or monarchies. Whether they are fascist or communist, our problem is to preserve our own. And very little, if anything, has been accomplished to assure us that World War was really the war to end all wars. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back at the hour of the time, today being the 17th of February, 2005. And I'd like to remind everybody you're listening to the Hour of the Time on 7.415 MHz and 9.330 MHz on WBCQ, Monticello, Maine. Now, if you'd like to write the Hour of the Time, to share research material, to donate for research material, to donate to keep the Hour of the Time broadcast and website and research going, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. Go to our website, hourofthetime.com, for a massive collection of research material, all put together in the hopes of saving our constitutional republic. You'll see there a massive amount of research archives available for donation that help us stay on the air and keep the website and the research going, and at the same time educate you on a whole plethora of subjects. If you'd like to email me, it is hourofthetime@hotmail.com. That's hourofthetime@hotmail.com. To leave a message at the studio, to share research, to ask questions, to use for call-in shows, it's the same number, 928-333-2942, 928-333-2942. Now, to continue on with Major General Retired Marine Corps Smedley Butler's War is a Racket piece, a nice reading that I suggest you find through a bookshop. It can be read in one sitting, and it's good to hand around. Having not read it in years and years, I can see a lot of the things I did when he talks about soldiers and how I was duped. And now I understand more so, having reread it this week, after years, literally junior high, why my father gave it to me in junior high. Now, back to the piece, Chapter 5, To Hell with War. Yes, we have had disarmament conferences and limitations of arms conferences. They don't mean a thing. One has just failed, the result of another has been nullified. We send our professional soldiers and our sailors and our politicians and our diplomats to these conferences, and what happens? The professional soldiers and sailors don't want to disarm. No admiral wants to be without a ship. No general wants to be without a command. Both mean men without jobs. They are not for disarmament. They cannot be for limitations of arms. And at all these conferences, lurking in the background but all-powerful just the same, are the sinister agents of those who profit by war. They see to it that these conferences do not disarm or seriously limit armaments. The chief aim of any power at any of these conferences has not been to achieve disarmament to prevent war, but rather to get more armament for itself and less for any potential foe. There is only one way to disarm with any semblance of practicality. That is, for all nations to get together and scrap every ship, every gun, every rifle, every tank, every warplane. Even this, if it were possible, would not be enough. Nor practical. The next war, according to experts, will be fought not with battleships, not by artillery, not with rifles, and not with machine guns. It will be fought with deadly chemicals and gases. Secretly, each nation is studying, perfecting newer and ghastlier means of annihilating its foes wholesale. Yes, ships will continue to be built, for the shipbuilders must make their profits, and guns still will be manufactured, and powder and rifles will be made, for the munitions makers must make their huge profits. And the soldiers, of course, must wear uniforms, for the manufacturers must make their war profits too. But victory or defeat will be determined by the skill and ingenuity of our scientists.
If we put them to work making poison gas and more fiendish mechanical and explosive instruments of destruction, they will have no time for the constructive job of building greater prosperity for all peoples of this country. By putting them to this useful job, we can all make more money out of peace than we can out of war, even the munition makers. So I say, to hell with war. That again, ladies and gentlemen, was War is a Racket, written by retired Major General, United States Marine Corps, Smedley Butler, two-time Congressional Medal of Honor winner. An excellent piece. And, as many of the examples that were pointed out by him, about war being a racket of the politicians and the manufacturers for profit, you would think that he was writing this piece today, not 80 years ago. Now, if you would like, of course, any of the broadcasts, they are a cost of $10, postage paid donation. Tell me what format you would like it on, CD or audio tape. And, of course, yesterday's and today's, like all the rest, are available for your donation. Some of you may have one heck of a time trying to find this book, or just may not want to read it all. So you can have the whole thing on audio and help at the same time, keep the hour of the time on the air. Now, just like as Monday I covered the World Economic Forum, I want to cover another piece, which will dovetail in when you see some of the implications of the World Economic Forum to something new and alarming that's come out, as of yesterday, in fact, on the news around this country. Now, this first one here concerning the World Economic Forum was a wonderful piece written by Miss Joan Vion. She deserves full credit, of course, for her work. Out of Davos, Switzerland, in a keynote speech today at the opening of the annual meeting of the World Economic Forum, French President Jacques Chirac called on the world's most powerful business leaders to help raise $50 billion a year to meet the United Nations Millennium Goals, agreed to in 2000. Citing the silent tsunamis of famine, infectious diseases, violence, revolt, anarchy, and extremism, Chirac referred to the outpouring of help from around the world for countries hit by the tsunami. He said, "The only effective response is coordinated international aid. The huge outpouring of generosity from all corners of the world bears witness to the assertion that a planetary awareness, a sentiment of world citizenship, does exist." Chirac went on to say, "Development is both the greatest challenge and the greatest urgency of our time, and called for a partnership between market forces and solidarity. With the global gross national product at $40 trillion, the French president said that $50 billion needed to have extreme poverty and malnutrition by 2015, provide universal primary education for children, reduce by two-thirds the mortality of children under five, half HIV/AIDS, and half the number of people who do not have access to drinking water and sanitation is minimal." To raise these monies, Chirac offered some old, new, and revised ideas. They are, 1. Increase official aid or overseas development assistance, ODA, from its current 0.2% of GDP to the targeted 0.7%. France supports the British proposal by Gordon Brown to set up an international finance facility which would float bonds in the international markets. All commitments by donor countries would go into the fund, and bonds would be floated based on the annual payments. Chirac suggests that these loans would be reimbursed by, quote, new resources, international taxes or levies, or voluntarily contributions such as a small levy tax of $1 on the 3 billion plane tickets sold each year worldwide,
and a levy on the fuel used by air and or sea transport. I want to read that again, ladies and gentlemen. All commitments by donor countries would go into the fund and bonds would be floated based on levies or voluntary contributions, such as a small levy or tax of $1 on the 3 billion plane tickets sold each year worldwide, and a levy on the fuel usage by air and or sea transport. That sounds, ladies and gentlemen, like the voluntary compliance system of the IRS or the income tax in the United States. Voluntary compliance, huh? 3. Encourage large developed countries to set up coordinated tax incentives to stimulate and encourage private donations for development to help capture some of the $220 billion that Americans give in charitable donations. Because only 3% goes outside of America, he felt some laws should be changed to capture some of these monies. Do you hear that, ladies and gentlemen? An international fund should now dictate where your chosen donated money goes to. They're not satisfied with the fact that only 3% goes outside of America. A tax of 0.1% on international financial transactions, which total $3 trillion per day. Claiming this was not a Tobin tax, it looks like it to me, since the Tobin tax was a higher percentage on international currency transactions. Ask countries that, quote, maintain bank secrecy to partially compensate for the consequences of world tax evasions through a levy of flows of foreign capital in and out of their territory to help the poor, end quote. The only way to facilitate that, ladies and gentlemen, would be through a completely electronic monetary system, a world monetary fund. 6. More corporations and financial organizations to set up foundations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to help the development of the world. I wonder who provided the computers for all the arrangements of this conference. With regards to overseas development assistance, again ODA, France and the UK have set up a time schedule for how they are going to increase their contribution. They currently give $7,253 million and $6,282 million respectively. It should be noted that Bush doubled ODA in 2002. We currently give somewhere around 0.23% of our GDP, which totals $16,254 million. This money is used for debt relief, technical cooperation, and emergency and disaster relief along with food aid. New Zealand gives the least at $165 million. With regard to the idea of more foundations, he probably does not know about the Rees Commission, which researched the early foundations set up by the Rockefellers, Mellons, Scaife, Pews, and Carnegies. Rees found that they were changing the whole fabric of society in America at taxpayer expenses. Most of these foundations are responsible for the international thinking calling for world government that pervades the world today. 10 years ago, I discovered the UN was going to float the idea of global taxation at the 1995 Social Summit in Copenhagen. Since then, I have followed it from the idea stage to the serious goal that it has become. From the UN to the IMF, World Bank, to the G8, and now to the World Economic Forum. I have a major problem with transferring my wealth to the poor. First, I believe it should be voluntary and not dictated. This constitutes socialism. Second, when I look at all the poor countries of Africa, many of them are members of the British Commonwealth, which means the Commonwealth outvotes us at the international level, since they have anywhere from 2 votes to 54 votes versus our 1, be it the United Nations, the World Bank, the World Trade, etc. Furthermore, many of the highly indebted poor countries HIPC that we are being asked to forgive their debt are part of the Commonwealth. As Britain decolonized countries primarily in Africa and around the world between 1946 and 1989, they were given votes at the UN since they were not independent. Many of the HIPC Commonwealth countries are rich in gold, bauxite, diamonds, copper, coal, and manganese. Lastly, who or which UN agency is going to verify that the money from these taxes are going to be used to accomplish the above goals? Americans had better decide what they are going to do about all this, for the CEOs of the world are signing on to global taxations. Talk about the devastation of a tsunami. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Hour of the Time. Now, I would like to point out again, besides the extreme world government dictatorship socialism that, Jacques Chirac put forth at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, the global taxation, so-called voluntary, even though it would be enforced as a tax and a levy, do you notice that he named a few specific areas as to why all this needs to take place, like famine, diseases, violence, revolt, anarchy, and extremism? At this point right now, in this country and around the world, are we not being constantly told about all these instances? Are they not being encouraged, promoted, fueled around the world? Famine, because of communist and socialist guerrilla and cell groups wiping out crops around the world to take power in countries, is the major cause of famine in this world. Diseases, are we not seeing now a new super AIDS virus? Besides the incredible failure of vaccinations and many, many multi-trillion dollar pharmaceuticals. In fact, is the new super AIDS virus having been reported now on the West Coast as well of the United States yesterday? Is it not already expanding as well as the massive amount in Russia, in Siberia specifically, that I reported previously on the Hour of the Time here? Are we not being constantly told that those of us who believe in a constitutional form of government, a republican form of government, freedom, not world socialism, are we not being constantly told by the media, the think tanks, the NGOs, non-government organizations, that we are extremist, anti-government? Are we not seeing revolt and anarchy throughout the world? Again, fueled categorically 99% of the time by Soviet-inspired socialist and communist cells. Fat people. Now, a piece that has come up recently in the news yesterday, too late for me to report on it when I had it in my hands, unfortunately, but it is on the website. That's why it is so important to always tune into the Hour of the Time and our website, hourofthetime.com, at least as long as we are here through your donations, that is, to the breaking events. Now, a couple pieces that I have saved the email links, excuse me, I can email the links to you concerning these articles by the Associated Press. If you would like, just simply email me, hourthetime@hotmail.com, and I'll gladly shoot them off to you. Or go to our website, which is the best way, hourofthetime.com. Washington AP, control towers at some airports could go dark between midnight and 5 a.m. under a cost-cutting plan the government is considering. The Air Traffic Controllers Union says the move would compromise safety. Lawmakers worry it could lead to service reductions in their states. Senate Commerce Committee Chairman Ted Stevens, Republican out of Alaska, said Wednesday that if the Federal Aviation Administration closes the tower in Fairbanks, Alaska during the early morning hours, it, quote, would be the most stupid suggestion I've ever heard from the bureaucracy, end quote. With three Texas airports on the list, closing towers at cities with military bases at a time of war is wrong, says Chris Pollitt, spokesman for Senator Kay Bailey and Hutchinson, Republican out of Texas. FAA spokesman Greg Martin said the agency is looking to adjust staffing to meet changes in demand. The FAA has not made a final decision and is reviewing each airport, he said. There are 48 airports that handle few commercial and cargo flights in those five late-night hours. Doug Church, spokesman for the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, said closing the towers for any period of time, quote, is just not safe, end quote. Federal air traffic controllers staff 315 airports, but not all do it around the clock. For example, Control Tower is at Mansfield Regional Airport in Ohio and at Palm Springs International Airport in California, operate only 17 hours, Martin said. In addition, there are 193 airports with scheduled commercial service that do not even have control towers. When a tower is empty, pilots are always in voice contact with the controller, either at the terminal radar approach or at a center, Martin said. Approach controls handle aircraft approaching and departing airports within about a 50-mile radius. The 21 centers handle much bigger segments of airspace. Church said it is important that pilots have controllers who can see runway conditions. The Bush administration has proposed a lean budget in 2006 for the FAA, yet next year, the FAA plans to hire and train over 1,200 air traffic controllers to handle and to replace those who are leaving. Representative John Mica, chairman of the House Transportation and Infrastructure's Aviation Subcommittee, said closing some of the towers for part of the day is a good idea. Quote, sometimes they have one or two planes landing at this airport and it's costing us tens of millions of dollars to keep them open, Mica said. With the FAA's budget problems, Mica said, more than 48 airports may need to have staffing hours reduced. We have to start looking at what makes sense financially. Ladies and gentlemen, I need you to understand, to openly tell everyone about this plan is a Hegelian principle. To propose such closures at a time when we are all under threat is idiotic. Watch for a major disaster taking place to justify a major tax and rebuilding of the tracking infrastructure, which would of course include greater transponder capabilities, not just for on the air but on the ground, and tracking capabilities of individual persons. Look for a major disaster to take place to justify a declaration of martial law or national emergency. Now, control towers at some airports could go dark under this cost-cutting plan. There are about 48 of them. The Federal Aviation Administration has not yet made a final decision and is revealing and reviewing each airport as it goes, the spokesman says. The airports on the list, Easton Airport, Pennsylvania, Abilene Regional Airport, Texas, Atlantic City International Airport, New Jersey, Albany County Airport, New York, Scranton International Airport, Pennsylvania, Bangor Airport, Maine, Birmingham International Airport, Alabama, Billings-Logan International Airport, Montana, Boise Air Terminal, Going Field, Idaho, Buffalo Niagara International Airport, New York, Burbank Glendale Pasadena Airport, California, Columbia Metropolitan Airport, South Carolina, Akron Canton Regional Airport, Ohio, Charleston Air Force Base International Airport, South Carolina, Colorado Springs Airport, Colorado, Yeager Airport, West Virginia, Duluth International Airport, Minnesota, DuPage Airport, Illinois, Des Moines International Airport, Iowa, El Paso International Airport, Texas, Fairbanks International Airport, Alaska, Fresno Yosemite International Airport, California, Fayetteville Regional Grannis Field Airport, North Carolina, Fort Wayne International Airport, Indiana, Fort Lauderdale Executive Airport, Florida, Spokane International Airport, Washington, Piedmont Triad International Airport, North Carolina, Tri-State Milton J. Ferguson Airport, West Virginia, Holman Regional Airport, Indiana, Lansing Capital City Airport, Michigan, Lubbock International Airport, Texas, Bluegrass Airport, Kentucky, Harrisburg International Airport, Pennsylvania, Manchester Airport, New Hampshire, Epley Airfield, Nebraska, Greater Peoria Regional Airport, Illinois, Reno Cannon International Airport, Nevada, Roanoke Regional Woodrum Field, Virginia, Greater Rochester International Airport, New York, Springfield Regional Airport, Missouri, Shreveport Regional Airport, Louisiana, Luis Munoz Marin International Airport, Puerto Rico, Syracuse Hancock International Airport, New York, Toledo Express Airport, Ohio, Tucson International Airport, Arizona, McGee Tyson Airport, Tennessee, Detroit Willow Run Airport, Michigan, Youngstown Warren Regional Airport, Ohio. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, you heard it on the Hour of the Time. If you'd like to check out these articles for yourself and check out a lot of other research, go to hourofthetime.com. If you'd like to email either myself or co-host Rob Houghton, you may do so by going to our website, hourofthetime.com, and right at the top of the page is a Contact Us link. My email address is hourofthetime@hotmail.com, and our address is P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. And the phone number to the studio, if you need to get hold of us, to share research, to ask questions, it is 928-333-2942. That is also the number when we have call-in shows, which we're going to be having quite a few of in the very near future. Again, I want to remind everybody that the Hour of the Time stays on the air. We conduct research. We communicate. We pay our bills. We maintain and keep the website there through your donations and your donations for research materials. Please do so. We have a horrendous amount covering categories that most people can't even imagine until they go through our complete catalog, which is available on our website, hourofthetime.com, or for $5 donation, I will shoot you a new, complete, up-to-date catalog, first-class mail, as soon as I get your request. You've been listening to Hour of the Time on WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 MHz and 9.330 MHz out of Monticello, Maine. Thank you, and may everybody have a good evening.
Have been suspended. Stay in your home. Do not attempt to contact loved ones, insurance agents, or attorneys. Shut up. Do not attempt to think or depression may occur. Stay in your home. Curfew is at 7 p.m. sharp after work. Anyone caught outside...